Blog Talk Radio.
Seven feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. The rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the leaves. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
Nice Beyond the Book Club with your moderator, host, Charles. And I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jalavette. Say hello, Jalavette. I think you need to turn your mic up. You're welcome.
Okay. Hello.
Yes.
Hello, Jalavette.
Hello.
Does it ever get old?
No, it doesn't.
All right. All right, you're real close on your mic there. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh, you ready to go?
Yes, I believe I am. I didn't get to make all the settings because of the... Tonight we're continuing our feature of Frederick Douglass' autobiography, The Abridged Edition. Life of the Narrative of American Slave, Frederick Douglass, taken from the Slave Narrative Compilation or Anthology published by Library of America, edited by William Andrews and Henry Louis Gates. We covered chapters 6 and 7 last week, and this week we expect to generate some discussion from chapters 8 and 9. In these chapters, he discusses his valuation, where he has to be assessed due to the death of one of the relatives in the family that holds our relatives in captivity. And so everybody had to be basically a census or an assessment of all the Negro property.
Mm-hmm.
And our ancestors were dispersed amongst their families by lot. They did some kind of sorcery, and we covered it on another program. It means lot, where you draw straws or some kind of casting of dice or whatever. I don't know what their method was of determination. What they termed lots, which is synonymous with the other examples I previously gave.
Mm-hmm.
But and he was fortunate to go back to the family whom he had been staying with for the past 5 years, because it could have turned out another way. And the family whom he was residing was relatively kind to him in stark comparison to many of the other farms and residences he may have been subjected to had his portion been differently.
Mm-hmm.
It is most egregious circumstance to have to choose between the lesser of many evils.
Right.
Let alone two. And I believe, you know, we've been having this discussion throughout the past few weeks concerning, you know, various political elections, and people will talk about, oh, well, at least this or at least that.
Right.
And by looking at this chapter, I can see how we have developed or been conditioned to only feel that we have only evil and more evil to choose from.
Right. And when you said that, actually, that was the first thing that came is that things aren't very different right now. We still are very quick to accept the idea of being able to choose between, you know, various evils as being, you know, a viable option for us.
Right, right. Like, these are the viable, these are the only options,
mm-hmm,
offered by the adversary.
But when I say viable, I mean we see them as in a positive way, as something that is forward moving, that we actually have our hand upon something that is worthy.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you. I'm just saying explaining it from our perspective, you know, and I was just explaining it from a more, I would say, objective perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how our people see it, you know. And I was just looking at it, just stepping outside of, you know, being black and living, being in captivity, just looking at it as it is.
Right.
Not, you know, from, you know, our bias, but just that we have not thought to say this is illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And, there are people who have thought it. It's not that I'm saying nobody thought it. I'm saying it hasn't been accepted.
Right.
By the mass of people. Yeah, people have been telling, I mean, we have always had our prophets, our teachers, and our who have been saying it, but has it taken hold to the mass of the population? The answer is resounding, wrong drum roll.
Right.
The answer will be no.
Right. All right.
Right. And he explains it here. He mentions the circumstance here on page 311, in the beginning of chapter 8. He said, in a very short time after he went to live in Baltimore, his old master's youngest son, Richard, died. So that means Colonel Lloyd, youngest son, Richard. Colonel Lloyd is actually his father.
Right.
His captive father. This would be like the reverse of Darth Vader or something.
Mm-hmm.
So Darth Vader's youngest son Richard died, and Richard would be Frederick's uncle,
mm-hmm.
okay, whom he doesn't claim in this narrative, understand, but just keeping up with the family, with the bloodline.
Right, correct.
Okay, yeah, he died in about 3 years and 6 months after the death, Captain Anthony died, so there were two deaths in that family. So Captain Anthony is where he's living now in the narrative in Baltimore. Okay.
Hmm.
So anyway, he's leaving Andrew and daughter Lucretia to share a stay a while on a visit to see his daughter. And well, he's just saying how when he died. So he died when he was away from home. Boom, basically. And so he gets and he said it was therefore necessary to have evaluation of the property, that it might be equally divided between Miss Lucretia and Master Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I was immediately sent for to be valued with the other property. Here again, my feelings rose up in detestation of slavery. I had now a new conception of my degraded condition.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this, I had become, if not insensible to my lot, at least partly so. Essentially, he said that. Because he talks about this later on, in his narrative, that how just being in it, you know, you just start to accept it, which is what we were complaining about or mentioning, however somebody wants to bring some terms in, about how we act like these are the only options, this is just how it is, because you get insensitive to it.
Right.
It's conditioning. That's why we said it was conditioning.
Right. That's what we were talking about, conditioning. We spoke about that on a previous episode as well.
Right, and that's the reason why we go all of these books about behavior analysis and black self-psychoanalysis, because we understand this is a mind condition to behave, think, respond to the stimuli of oppression.
Right.
And we respond to it by endorsing it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so endorsing certain factions of it. Which, you know, we haven't developed the cunning, the motivation, the organization takes to think any other way.
I don't know if it's only that. I think a lot of it too, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, I think a lot of it is we haven't quite gotten a full distaste for it, wanting to completely divorce ourselves from, you know, this type of system, as opposed to wanting to just get our part of it.
Yeah, well, you're right. You're absolutely right. We've talked about that. Yeah, I think you're totally right. I want to say at that time of the writing of this book, when he composed, well, maybe not even after the time of the writing of this book we're reading, I think our people really wanted as freedom to us at that time was like sovereignty is to us right now. See, we are considered free by Frederick Douglass and our ancestors at that time standards.
Right.
And so, like we talked about, the next level is to achieve self-rulership, not just being able to not have to report to Mansell at a certain time or I'm going to get the lash if I don't show up to do his bidding, you know.
Right.
We move from that level of oppression to another level of oppression, which is less severe than what they, you know, we were living at that time.
Right.
And now we're supposed to be moving the ball to a higher, we're supposed to be ascending.
Right.
And we're not ascending.
And, you know, I was just talking the other day with a longtime friend, and we were talking about the situation today and the way that, you know, we have evolved into a different form of oppression, where Amos speaks about how we're allowed to walk around without chains because we don't need them.
Right, right. The chains, really, yeah. It's like when Kunta Kinte is, when he's first brought to the plantation where he would be working, they kept him in chains until they were certain of that he was broken.
Correct. Right.
And he was in chains an exceedingly longer amount of time than
all the rest
of the captives.
And that's the brokenness that is difficult. That's the conversation that we don't want to have. You know, Neely Fuller talks about that. And he talks about it in such very plain terms that it is It stings. It stings. When we talk to him and you hear these things that he's saying, and it's clear, it's understandable, but it's just not a conversation that we're ready to have, because the fact of the matter is that we are born of a people who were domesticated or broken. Okay. And so, you know, as I was saying the other day when we were speaking, that at what point were these, you know, slaveholders, kidnappers, flesh trade, you know, operators, at what point were they able to sleep on their farms, you know, a family of five or six or ten to, you know, upwards of, you know, several hundred indentured, you know, enslaved people? How were they able to do that unless, you know, this massive group of people had been completely subjugated in their mind, in their thinking, in their very psyche, their souls? And so multiply that generationally, multi-generationally, and then you get to where we are today. And while it is painful to want to think that who we are today was born and bred of, you know, that type of conditioning, it really was. And until we're able to really wrap our minds around that and understand what freedom is and what perceived freedom is, and to be able to differentiate, it's unfortunate that we will never attain true freedom, because as the quote by Thoreau says, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who believe that they are free.
Quote by who?
Thoreau.
Oh.
The what was his name? Henry David Thoreau.
Oh. I thought that was another person, German guy.
Or was it Van?
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Van Gogh. But right. Yeah. You know. That's, we are domesticated. We were brought here like cattle, like livestock, bred and taught to toil, and though many of us escaped, you know, as a group, we escaped, and we were industrious. We did many great things under the conditions, but the point is, we were under the conditions.
Right.
I mean, that's a, you know, yeah, we did a lot of awesome things, and we're still doing awesome things, but we're still under the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a constant.
Right.
And that's the constant that we hope to try to make it no longer a constant.
Right, but that's the difficult conversation. That's the difficult conversation. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
Because I listened to the narratives, this one and we're looking at
other narratives.
Eric Jacobs, yeah, and you see the way that these people are able to put, you know, and fit together ideas and concepts. They understand the subjugation under which they live. They understand it fully. They are not fooled in any way.
Right.
And so then if I were to then surmise that in some ways our mentality, our faculties, our thinking faculties were more intact at that time, then that would be difficult and completely unpalatable. When, if you look at it on an intellectual level, at that point we were younger under this system, having lived under this system, and therefore maybe just a little less traumatized.
Less broken.
Less broken.
Yeah.
So we were able to, you know, fit the, you know, round peg in the round hole.
Yeah.
Now, our thinking now is, we're like, you know, trying to slam this square peg in the round hole, and it's just not working. And then if someone says, well, points out, well, that's not the right, you know, hole there, it's trying to, you know, do that.
And so you must be for Romney. That's the reply. Right. I understand.
Oh, you caught me off guard with someone.
I know. That's my intention. That's the essence of comedy.
That would be the reply. Is this, you know, today, I gotta say this really quickly.
Okay.
We get back to the book. There was a post about the fact that in several states, I think it's 30, over 30 states, if a woman is raped and there is a child produced from this rape, that the rapist, under whatever circumstances, can actually file for visitation and custody and these kinds of things of the baby. And so while this is absolutely, you know, horrific, I get an inbox that says, where did this come from? Did it come from Obama or did it come from Romney? So now what I am faced with now is someone who, depending on what camp this information came from, is going to not be able to make a decision on the value of the information itself. Because you can't think for yourself because your thinking is directly influenced by which team you're on. If you're on the red team, the blue team, is go, you know, Lakers, whoever, whatever. It just depends. Who said that? Oh, okay, well, yeah, I agree with it. Somebody else said that? Mm-mm, I don't agree with that. It's probably not true.
Right, instead of just Googling, going on the search engine and trying to fact-check it.
Right.
And you can have feelings about it before fact-checking it. You can say, hey, I'm going to like this, I don't like it, but I'm going to see if it's true, because if it is true, I don't like it. If it's not true, I still wouldn't like it, even if...
That's what I'm saying. It's not a matter of making a decision on truth.
Right.
It's not a matter of deciding regarding truth. It's the decision is regarding the cult of personality or whatever erroneous, you know...
Frivolous
system of determination that we have. And that's the kind of thinking I think that is going to be most difficult for us to, you know, really get out of because...
Well, we won't as a group because, you know, Julian Huxley wrote about it in Brave New World. Well, no, he didn't. He commented on his grandfather's work in Brave New World, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
We watched that clip and he mentioned how they wanted us to be dumbed down to the point that we're like domesticated livestock.
Like livestock, yeah.
Understand the difference between wild animals and domesticated, and wild animals understand the difference between self-governance and being under somebody's control.
Right, and more simply, they understand self-preservation.
Right, wild animals are
all it's about. It's about self-preservation.
Wild animals they have to be broken to become domesticated.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? And that's the point. He used the sheep or some other kind of domesticated farm animal as a simile, because that's what has to be done to the human mind. It has to be broken and conditioned to be a servant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Dr. Amos, I was talking about, our education is to make us servants. Your college education, your high school education, your religious ceremonies, your rituals, the interpretation of the rituals, let me change that. The interpretation of the rituals and the interpretation of the writings of ancient people is designed or taught to render you incapable. You, that is just, that's a plural, you, okay? Second, to render you to be servants of another. You know, not everybody has to serve something, okay? But we're talking about in this war that we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, you know, like you were mentioning earlier about the person who unable to say, that's messed up. I don't care which camp it came from.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not living in that state, which would be almost, in my opinion, a proper response. I don't like that information. I hope that's not true where I live or where anyone lives.
Mm-hmm.
and I want to find out more about that.
Mm-hmm.
The question shouldn't be, because what makes you think it necessarily came from a presidential campaign office? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's the first thing you go to, because really that's what you wanted, that person wanted to attack.
Right.
They really wanted to wage a war on whose team of who are you endorsing for the presidency.
Right.
And that was the reason why they had to inject that into the discussion, because they don't really care about rape, mothers, and custody cases.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really give a crap about that. They really care about who you're voting for, and if you vote on, you're supporting the right person.
Right.
And that's what that is. But and we digress, because basically.
Yes, let's digress. We have to get back to the book. All right, you ready?
Right, yes.
We do that a lot.
Yes, we do.
We break off into other topics and stuff. Okay, come on.
Yeah, but it was relevant though.
Yes.
He says, but he's back at the plantation, Colonel Lloyd's plantation, who is his evil father.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells us that when he gets back, he's now about 10 or 11 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about, you know, being everybody being having to like go and be valued. He says everybody. He says here that we were all ranked together at the valuation. Men, women, old and young, married and single, were ranked with horses, sheep, and swine. There were horses and men, cattle and women, pigs and children, all holding the same rank in the scale of being, and were all subject to the same narrow examination. Silvery-headed age and sprightly youth maids and matrons had to undergo the same indelicate inspection. At this moment, I saw more clearly than ever the brutalizing effects of slavery upon both slave and slaveholder. You hear that last clause?
That's right, slave and slaveholder.
Right, that prepositional phrase, upon both slave and slaveholder, tells you that, like some people, like, this whole effect is bad for everybody. The point is, the people who are the dynamic person in this act, which is the European, they're the dynamic person. Black people, we are the passive partner.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the thing being acted upon. The noun being subjected to the action of the verb or brutalization or brutalizing, we're the object of the verb.
Right.
And so we are in it. It affects us negatively, and it affects the person doing the brutalizing. It makes them crazier. We look at their activities, particularly watching this show called Taj Point Out.
Right.
You can see how much more mad they're becoming as a result of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Now, we can say they've always been crazy. Yeah, of course you had to be crazy to even begin this enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
To even begin to do the horrors that they would do, you had to be off.
Mm-hmm.
How much more off are you going to be after 500 years of doing it? You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Of course they're further off. It's super crazy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, we have to understand that we're getting worse off too.
Mm-hmm.
The longer we're under it. Though we may have fits of sanity, moments of clarity like we're having right now in 2012 and 2010. I think we've been, you know, like this renaissance of black appreciation to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
Or the appearance thereof. I think this is a part of our fit of sanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got to do something with that fit. You know, are we going to grow? Are we going to plant that seed in of clarity? We're going to do as much as we can, you know, to advance our condition, our station, while we appear things, you know, people appear to understand or give attention to, live their ear to these kinds of topic or this kind of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we going to say, oh, it's going to get better now because natural hair is in. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Just sit back, put our feet up, you know, on a coffee table and just see where this thing takes us. We'll see. If we want to move out of a passive position, we're going to take more action and become a dynamic partner, which is why Dr. Wilson would say something like, we have to stop being what we are so that the oppressor can stop being what he is. So when you start taking different kinds of action, responding to the stimulus of a brutalizing brutality differently, then everything has to change. When one variable changes, the whole system, the whole reaction changes.
Mm-hmm.
Cannot function the same way it did when all the variables were constant. Okay?
All right.
And by knowing that, understanding that, and behaving and utilizing and changing more and more variables.
Right.
The more variables you change, the more things cannot remain the same, thereby removing that constancy of the intensity of brutality that we've been under, changing that condition that we spoke about maybe 10, 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
See. And that's what we can do. Like I said, we have, many of us like to talk about things that we are unable to do, some, like, you know, Herculean task, you know. But if we could kind of bring it down a notch, just not be so grand.
Yep.
Bring it down.
Okay. Bring it down. Break it down.
Bring it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how about, you know, working up to that someday?
Hey, okay.
But right now,
you can take a hint.
Let's do this in. This is easy.
Okay.
And pull that off. Won't you read some of these books?
Yes. And that is something we can do.
Educate your children. Can you? I think you can do that.
Yes.
I think you can cut back certain kinds of activities. How about, you know, learning about how do societies, healthy societies, that aren't destroying their own people and that love themselves, how do they function? We got to learn how to do that. Black men, black women got to learn how to love each other and support each other to create a holistic and healthy society.
Mm.
Oh, that's been a real big toughie. Can't talk about being pro-black nothing if you can't do that. on and get back, go back, pick up your plow and go back on the plantation with Mr. Colonel Lloyd.
I understand what you're saying, and I wasn't trying to be grand. I was just trying to say that
I wasn't talking to you.
I mean, well, I put myself in there too, because you know I don't want to be, you know, I don't want it to be, you know, misunderstood what it is that I'm saying.
What? I wasn't talking about you though. I mean, personally.
No, you weren't talking about me personally, but. You know, when you say things like that, well, I analyze myself, too.
Well, of course. I mean, you can, but you can look at it. You know what you're doing.
I know, but anyway, okay. I'm not going to go back and forth.
I think I probably ruined it.
That's okay, Honey Boo Boo. Oh, God, did I just call you Honey Boo Boo?
I think you did.
That's scary. Mm.
Yeah. But anyway.
Anyway, let's go.
Anyway. Anyway, he says after the evaluation, then came the division. Now, I don't know how many people in the audience understand, but when our people are being, our ancestors were being evaluated and parted out, divvied up between European colonial family members. They were divided up. They didn't give a doggone about mother had a child. They would separate mother from child. They did. They treated us no different from the livestock on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very anxious school right here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mean you out there plowing the fields or whatever you're doing, working in the tannery, or you out shoeing horses, being a blacksmith, whatever you're doing on the farm, cleaning the house, or they call you out there and they tell you you're going to live with such and such relatives, you know, hop on that wagon.
Right.
And you don't know where you're going. They don't really give a doggone either. You say your goodbyes and that's it.
Right.
You got a baby. Your baby gonna stay here or go over there with goodness knows whom, and you're never gonna see that child ever again.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reality.
Yes.
Of our past. Okay, I'm not going to say it was, because it has happened to us today in penal institutions and other kinds of places where they keep us locked up.
Yes.
Now we have it with the CPS now, and which our people totally wholeheartedly support, and we report to each other to those agencies.
Oh, absolutely.
So
we think that it's necessary because we're unable to police ourselves.
Yeah, we hate ourselves. I mean, you know, we even fabricate stories on each other if necessary. But anyway, so that's the reality of how we've gone down, you know, in this society that we really want to, you know, be so much part of. He said, I have no language to express the high excitement and deep anxiety which were felt among us poor slaves during this time. Our fate for life was now to be decided. We had no more voice in that decision than the brutes among we were ranked.
Mm-hmm.
A single word from the white men was enough against all of our wishes, prayers, and entreaties to sunder forever the dearest friends, dearest kindred, and strongest ties known to human beings. In addition to the pain of separation, there was the horrid dread of falling to the hands of Master Andrew. He was known to us all as being the most cruel wretch, a common drunkard who had, by his reckless mismanagement and profligate dissipation, already wasted a large portion of his father's property. And he was such a loser, wasn't he? Got all that money. He wasted it all. We all felt that we might as well be sold at once to the Georgia traders as to pass into his hands, for we knew that would be our inevitable condition,
mm-hmm.
a condition held by us all in utmost horror and dread. Now, this guy's obviously a rapist or something, you know what I'm saying?
Something really bad, right.
Yeah, he's not just drunk. He's out, you know, he getting drunk, he raping people, you know, just probably killing folks, shooting people in the head, like you read in the previous chapter.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is a monster. He's a, you know, he's an exceptional demon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
he's really good at it.
Yeah, he's really good. He's taken to the evil so well to higher levels of depravity than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, this is about the lesser of evils, the greater and lesser of evils we're, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're accustomed to. And here is a case in point of that kind of existence that we were subjected to on a regular and constant, a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the death of any one of the important members, any member holding in these families, boom, here we go up in the toss in the lot again. You know, and it's kind of like what it is now. If you look at it, like, I think you mentioned this. In your language earlier this evening, you were saying how like we're basically choosing which master, you know, and so we're trying to get a kinder master,
right?
Now that's the whole thing about elections for us for black people in America. Is about we want the kindest master. I'm not saying that, you know, you shouldn't, you know, I'm saying, oh, you should hope you get the meanest master. It doesn't matter, but, I mean, do it, you know, whatever you're doing, man, you know. But don't get so worked up about this master. You want to get rid of the whole master choosing, throw it all away at the end of the day. It's really what you want, supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? But it seems like we have settled into, like, that's all we want. And you know what, I think we all wanted to mention about how you had a conversation with an old buddy, and they mentioned how they didn't want your program Woman Song was causing them to confront a lot of issues that they hadn't dealt with, so they had to stop listening to the program because they didn't want to address that, because, you know, you want to recount that for us tonight?
Well, we were having a conversation about racism, and this is a person who believes that, you know, racism doesn't exist, or that I am overreacting. to racism. And so what he told me was that he could no longer listen to the woman's song broadcast because what happened was he would find himself listening to the show on Sunday, and when he would go back to work on Monday, he would get, you know, very short and far less tolerant of his coworkers of the Caucasian persuasion, and that one particular day, you know, he said he you know, he was within an inch of, you know, losing it on this person, and so he stopped and sat down and calmed himself, and then he thought about it, and he realized that it was because he was listening to the show and that it was making him confront issues that he had otherwise left tucked away. And when he did that, then, you know, he was faced with his own inaction, and his frustration, you know, grew, and that kind of thing. And so anyway, fast forward, what he determined, his answer was not that he would be more proactive in trying to, you know, obtain his freedom as best we can under this type of oppression. Instead, his answer was to no longer listen to the show.
Yeah. And that's his resolution.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's most of our people's resolution,
right,
to not deal with it, not think about, not analyze it, to just, we want, I mean, like he wanted to have instant gratification.
Right.
Because, you know, because we need to, a lot of us, you know, we need to, you know, we need therapy, you know, we need to decompress and debrief.
Right.
From this experience.
Right. Just think of what all we went through. Our answer,
going through.
When I say we, I mean oftentimes we'll try to say, you know, that I wasn't there. I didn't go through that, this, that, and the other. But yes, you did.
Yes, you did.
Because you were with your ancestors, and that person, those people who had been subjected to that type of trauma, taught that to their offspring, who taught that to their offspring, who taught that to you. And so any other circumstance, we can understand the cycle of abuse, the, you know, the cycle of you know, these types of behaviors being passed down from generation to generation, and, you know, the cycle of teen pregnancy, the cycle of this, and, you know, her grandmother had a baby at 12, she had one at 13, and now she's a grandmother at 22. We understand it when it's other things, but for some reason, when we talk about, you know, the type of mentality that was passed down, which was basically a mentality of brokenness that was passed down, for some reason, it is incumbent upon us. We believe, and we all know, really, the truth is that it is absolutely in the best interest of white supremacy that we do not look at that as a true condition, because then we could actually begin to back out of it, correct it, and then, you know, we would then be compelled to do something,
right,
about it. And so I don't think that I think we're afraid, really. You know, I say that all of the time. I think it's just fear.
Yeah.
Based. We're afraid because everybody, there's no amount of book club meetings, or any other lecture, whatever, the books have been written. They've been written to death. There's nothing, no magazine, no e-zine, no Tumblr, no blog spot, no vlogs, no video, nothing. There's nothing else that needs to be said that hasn't been said already. The fact of the matter is that we don't want to do anything because we are afraid.
Right, that, and on top of that, none of those things you just mentioned is going to make you confront those issues yourself.
Right.
They can't make you do it.
Mm-mm.
That's something that only you can do. And without doing that, your condition will remain arrested.
And those are the things, those are the types of points or discussions that make what it is that we're saying widely unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
Because what garners popularity, we all know, is things that are non-threatening. Let's talk about who we were as opposed to who we are and who we should and are obligated to become. Or let's talk about a whole bunch of stuff that we know we're not going to do.
Well, yes, I was going to finish your sentence. You know, you remember we had Brother Ezra Aharon on the African Conversations program discuss his book, the In Stone series, Upon Sovereignty. In his book, he had an interesting idea, which I had never thought to articulate, but this is it. He said, I just remember, he said, we ought to be ashamed to brag about how we was kings and queens, being we were taken to being slaves so easy and so long. We was a mighty people from the dawn of time to now, and only for the last 500 years, a very short time, 500 years is a blip on the dot of the timeline of humanity.
Right.
500 years, we settled in.
Right.
We have settled in and made ourselves at home as being the servants of people who brutalize us on a regular basis.
And not only that, but we've cozied up next to them and asked, could we please, may I have another?
Right. Now, that wasn't a direct quote from his book, but
I understand.
Right. I'm just saying for the audience and for the record.
Right.
But that's it. We got to be trying to return to that greatness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or shut the hell up about it. You know what I mean?
And it's scary to me because when you talk about something as simple as Fuller's concept of replacing this system with a system of justice, we're talking about displacing all that we've ever known to be right. You see, we've allowed these people who otherwise brutalized us to become our moral authority.
Yeah.
We look to them for laws and what is appropriate and acceptable and what is right. We wait for them to tell us these things, and we parrot them and sheepdog others. And what Fuller is saying, which, you know, he just straight out says, we're stupid. We are,
I concur,
less intelligent than the white man, because if we weren't, we wouldn't be in this situation. See, those are the things that I was talking about that, you know, if you look at it in a very, very, you know, in very simple terms, it makes sense. Now, I didn't like that when Fuller said that. I didn't like it at all. It had a sting to it. And when he said it, I just, you know, I was poised to defend, you know.
Right.
But when he elaborated and he explained, what do you say behind that?
You have no defense.
There's no defense.
Countering what he's saying.
You just say, well,
Because I mean,
so what I did to soothe myself at that time, because now I'm okay with it now. I've evolved and I understand what he's saying, and he's very right. But what I did at that time when he said that, and he explained it, what I said was, well, you know, you just don't have to say it like that. But the truth is, yes, he does. He needs to say it exactly like that.
Exactly like that, right.
You know.
Because I remember growing up, even my cousin was over here, and we were talking, and he was saying, you know, how, you know, we smarter than them. And
yeah, no.
My parents used to tell, my mother used to say that, oh, yeah, they don't know this, and we know. I'm like, and I got to be older, and I started reading a lot more books, you know, written by them about how they do things and how they face challenges and overcome things. I'm like, you know, we're not.
No.
Yeah. You know, no. They are. They know what the hell they're doing, and we don't. And they know how to stay on top, and we don't know how to get out from the bottom. So if we can't think, in other words, if we were on top of the world, which we were, I mean, I'm just speaking like in this term. Since we were on top of the world for so many thousand years, they got, when we weren't oppressing them in this way either. And so it was a lot easier to do. and we were free and doing our thing, sovereign people, which we know there's some metaphysics and some, you know, spiritual things, that reason why you and I know why all of this is occurring. You can check out our other program.
Right.
Out, but we just won't cover that here so much.
Right.
But how in the hell explain, justify moving from the top of the world to the absolute bottom of the world with no means of rectifying the situation? You move from the top to the bottom, and then you get to the bottom, and we beg and plead for leniency. That's all we do.
Mm-hmm.
Cannibalize on each other,
and ask the perpetrator to please stop perpetrating.
I mean, well, you know, we don't mind him brutalizing, but just, you know, we want special, you know, special favors for certain groups, you know, like the
nice about it.
You get like this smart set or black upper class, they want special favors, and then they see favors being extended to another group, they get jealous of the other group because the mouse are giving them favors and not so many to them anymore. You know what I'm saying? And we all this kind of craziness going on in the BC, that is the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of that. And we know people out there, you know what I'm saying, know what's up, what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They call other people bootstrappers and whatnot.
That's right.
And they doing the same thing. Everybody, all these people, groups of are begging off a mouse table,
mm-hmm.
talking about each other, and that's no way. Nothing gonna come out of there but more beggary.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? More black on black hatred. You know, just different, you know, manifestations of the same self-hatred.
Mm-hmm.
No resolution. And you know what? It's not going to get any better because the people are becoming, remember I just mentioned earlier that our oppressors are becoming more brutal. He's becoming sicker. So that means the brutality is getting sicker. It's going to increase. It's already increasing.
Right.
But we just have enough creature comforts so far,
mm-hmm.
until they finish doing whatever kind of reorganizing the colonial powers are doing, and once they get to wherever it is they go, they going, I think they're gonna turn it up past 1830.
Yeah.
See.
I agree.
They're gonna turn up the volume on that AZZ, and they're gonna be looking around. Our people be looking around like we're looking crazy. I don't know what happened. Where this come from? Like I've been told that a long time ago. A Negro, you crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, you experiencing what I told you experience. Shut up. You must be going for Romney.
You want to take a break?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Thank you so much for listening. People in our chat room and those listening live on the browser, if you'd like to call in and be a part of the discussion, the phone number is 323-580-5707, and we will be back in just a moment.
Listen in to African Conversations on the African Knowledge Network, where we will converse with researchers about matters significant to the African diaspora community. Join us on Facebook on the African Conversations community page. Enjoy the dialogue on African Conversations on blogtalkradio.com. Listen to Love in Black with Charles and Jolivet on the Tribal Family Station on blogtalkradio.com.
There we will share our experiences and our insights on marriage and love, sex, respect, and honor. We're on every Thursday evening on the Tribal Family Station.
My name is Eric Diemer, host of Common Sense Conversations. Join me every Tuesday and Friday when I put common sense where it ain't so common. That's Common Sense Conversations every Tuesday and Friday. 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Common Sense Conversation on blogtalkradio.com.
Join the Woman's Song Community Experience every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com. We will do the thing that many think cannot be done.
African Knowledge Beyond the Book appears every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are a literary society dedicated to the study of African-based psychoanalytical texts. We hope you will join us as we delve into the inner working of our African consciousness. African Knowledge Beyond the Book, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com.
Welcome to AfricanImpressions.com. African Impressions is a Black-owned business that offers products made by the global African community. African Impressions offers the finest in African-made jewelry, craft, clothing, and so much more. As the renaissance of the African community rapidly approaches, you need to add acquiring products crafted by members of the global African family to your repertoire of activities. We must rediscover more of our ancient cultural habits, which we struggle to regain, and incorporate them into our daily lives. Support African craftsmen and women by shopping at AfricanImpressions.com today. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club. We're continuing our discussion with tonight's feature, A Life and Narrative, A Narrative of Life of American Slave, Frederick Douglass. We're still in Chapter 8, and we just got through giving our commentary on Douglass's condition as he's being valued for reassignment or potential reassignment. And we're discussing how that relates to our current condition, the way we live today. And before I get back into where we're going now, he's going to discuss Master Andrew. That was a horrible man who was talking about in the previous paragraph. You were discussing about how we went through this experience. This was our experience, not just our ancestors' experience, but as well as our own. But Dr. Amos Wilson mentions in his book, Developmental Psychology of the Black Child, he cites research that you get a template of your central and peripheral nervous system. Well, you know, everybody knows you were made in the likeness of your ancestors, right?
Mm-hmm.
You inherit their bones, you know, structure, whatever their health was at the time, your health is patterned after that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Your makeup, you look like they look, you know, and that's no different from my nervous system. The stress that they endured, you all, your nervous system has the scar, the memory of that stress. You got it too. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So I was just, not only do we get it through, you know, through learning, through education, instruction, through socialization, but we also get it inherently.
Right.
Not just an inheritance of like they just gift it to, but you get it, you know, just inside the core of your being. You have it handed right over to you. The experiences of your ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And all the glory and all of their ignobility. So, we can always choose to actualize potential long latent within us. Now, that's what we were talking about, the greatness of our ancestors, where we, you know, whatever part of the world we choose to identify with, blackness, you know, because we, you know, we came from all over to where we are now. So whatever you choose to connect with, you can actualize that and draw up on that strength of those great peoples and not have to draw up on the experience here, which is already immediately available to you. That's going to take a lot more work, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that takes a lot more effort and cultivating to try to overcome our immediate experience, because it's always right here to slap us in the face.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So it's not going to be easy. It's going to be extremely hard, which is why we have this program.
All right.
To motivate our people to do the work to get to that point,
mm-hmm.
to strive for that instead of the things that we are currently doing. Yeah. You know. But anyway. I'm going to move on to his more in-depth description of Master Andrew. He says, here on page 312, I suffered more anxiety than most of my fellow slaves. I had known what it was like, what it was to be kindly treated. They had known nothing of the kind. They had seen little or nothing of the world. They were in very deed men and women of sorrow and acquainted with grief. Their backs had been made familiar with the bloody lash so that they had become callous.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was yet tender, for while at Baltimore I got few whippings, and few slaves could boast of a kinder master and mistress than myself.
Mm-hmm.
The thought of passing out of their hands into those of Master Andrew, a man who but a few days before to give me a sample of his bloody disposition, took my little brother by the throat, threw him on the ground, and with the heel of his boot stamped upon his head till the blood gushed from his nose and ears, was well calculated to make me feel anxious as to my fate. After he had committed this savage outrage upon my brother, he turned to me and said that was the way he meant to serve me one of these days, meaning, I suppose, when I came into his possession. Thanks to a kind providence, that is God, his own capital P, fell to the portion of Mrs. Lucretia and was sent immediately back to Baltimore. That's his current mistress at the time of this narrative. To live again in the family of Master Hugh. Their joy at my return equaled the sorrow at my departure. It was a glad day to me. I had escaped a worse than lion's jaws. I was absent from Baltimore for the purpose of valuation and division just about 1 month, and it seemed to have been six.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, this is what he had his brother was practically murdered right before his eyes, you know. Because one of their relatives was a raging demoniac, and you know nothing happened to Master Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Master Andrew. Okay, even on the channel end, they can say he damaged property. They could say, hey, this was cruel, unusual, and you almost caused a lot of losing by it. So they could, you know, if they beat Andrew, you know. White folks like talk about what's in the Bible, and the Bible condones slavery. And the Bible says the person do something like this, the person supposed to be set free for having to do with that kind of cruelty, but not according to what these people are doing. Matter of fact, kidnapping is, you know, this whole system is a capital punishment in many of the ancient, I would say all of the ancient societies. But however we're dealing with the people who they feel like it's capital punishment when you do them, when you do it to one of them and not nobody else. They don't believe in the reciprocation of justice. You see what I'm saying?
No, yeah.
I mean, treating people like you want to be treated.
Right.
No, they don't believe in this. Is this kind of this culture that in which we live and in which we have been, in which we are dying, rather not live, in which we are dying, does not believe in the reciprocation of justice. They only believe in justice as if they are only when they are the beneficiary.
Right.
But if somebody else is going to be a beneficiary, then no justice, no.
Mm-hmm.
Point blank. It's only one way. Ain't no justice out of nothing else other under this system. So ain't no election going to solve your problems in the capacity. You know? Just understand it's just going to continuation. This is how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So anyway, he goes on, he says about how his master, I think that's Master Andrew, that's the evil guy. He ends up dying.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness. That couldn't happen soon enough. Whew, soon as he got back to Baltimore, the low-down, evil, dirty rat, son of a nothing, Master Andrew died. And all the property of his old master slaves included was in the hands of strangers. They mean people who weren't in the family. Strangers who had nothing to do with accumulating it. So not a slave was left free, but they didn't release anybody. Because Master Andrew didn't have a will. Oh, we're surprised. Spent all this time with hookers and gamblers.
Good for nothing.
Good for nothing. Swindlers. Carpetbaggers and others.
Tricksters.
Pirates, names, ass marauders, and other whatnots.
Did you say knaves? Did you say knaves?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He says, if any one thing in my experience more than another served to deepen my conviction of the infernal character of slavery, it could be an infernal, fiery, or hellish
character
of slavery.
Right.
And to fill me with unutterable loathing of slaveholders, it was their base ingratitude to my poor old grandmother. She had served my old master faithfully from youth to old age. She had been the source of all his wealth, meaning helping to make sure them babies was born.
Yes.
Making sure people had sex and didn't, you know, and made sure they were fertile. You know, that's what she did, you know, which we should stop doing. She had been the source of, what was that? Yeah, she had been the source of all his wealth. She had peopled his plantation with slaves. She had become a great grandmother in his service. She had rocked him in infancy, attended him in childhood, and served him through life. And at his death, wiped from his icy brow the cold death sweat and closed his eyes forever. She was nevertheless left a slave. I mean, he didn't set her free upon his death as a gift.
Right.
Nevertheless left a slave for life, a slave in the hands of strangers, and in their hands she saw her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren divided like so many sheep. Meaning when he went back to wherever the Conlow plantation, he didn't say where that plantation was, but he saw his grandmother, brought up old memories. She's still there. And so, remember he talked about the Georgia slave traders.
Right.
So apparently, well, he says she saw her children, you know, given to the hands of strangers and whatever, divided like so many sheep without being gratified with the small privilege of a single word as to their or her own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And to cap the climax of their base ingratitude and fiendish barbarity, my grandmother, who was now very old, having outlived my old master, she probably excessed 70 years, and all his children, having been seen the beginning and end of all of them, and her present owners finding She was of but little value, her frame already racked with the pains of old age and complete helplessness, fast stealing over her once active limbs. They took her to the woods, built her a little hut, put up a little mud chimney, and then made her welcome to the privilege of supporting herself there in perfect loneliness, thus virtually turning her out to die. If my poor old grandmother now lives, she lives to suffer in utter loneliness. She lives to remember and mourn over the loss of children, the loss of grandchildren, the loss of great-grandchildren. They are, in the language of the slave's poet Whittier, gone, gone, sold and gone, to the rice swamp, dank and lone, where the slave ship ceaseless swings, where the noisome insect stings, where the fever demon strews, poisoned with the falling dews, where the sickly sunbeams glare through the hot and misty air. Gone, gone, sold and gone, to the rice swamp, dank and lone, from Virginia hills and waters, woe is me, my stolen daughters. So, he said, the hearth is desolate, the children, the unconscious children who once sang and danced in her presence are gone. She gropes her way in the darkness of age for a drink of water. Instead of the voices of her children, she hears day, the moans of the dove, and by night the screams of the hideous owl. All is gloom, the grave is at the door, and now, when weighed down by the pains and aches of old age, when the head inclines to the feet, when the beginning and ending of human existence meet, and helpless infancy and painful old age combine together at this time, this most needful time, the time for the exercise of that tenderness and affection which children can only exercise toward a declining parent. Poor old grandmother, the devoted mother of 12 children, is left all alone in yonder little hut. For a few dim embers, she stands, she staggers, she falls, she groans, she dies. And there are none of her children or grandchildren present to wipe from her wrinkled brow the cold sweat of death, and to place beneath the sod her fallen remains. Will not a righteous God visit for these things? You know?
Yeah.
And that's the end of us in this system. Thank all your hard work, all your service, the fruit of your body. You will give much service in their wars, in their medical institutions for the healing of their bodies and the building of their institution, the education system, by teaching their children and make sure they prosper and wax on top of your lives and your future, rather, in addition to that. And so we continue to decline, live, wax, and die. And our wax and weed cause them to wax greater, and they stand up on us. And I think that's it for tonight.
Wow.
I think that's an interesting note by which to conclude the program.
Mm-hmm. That is an interesting note. That was interesting. You know, and let me just say this. I know that, you know, we're about to wind it up, but I want to say this. You know, maybe I've said this before, when I'm reading, you know, the words that they're saying and the way that they are able to philosophize and, you know, very clearly express themselves, they seem so aware. You would never think that these people, many of them, you know, were taught to read, you know, in a shack. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, learning an entire, you know, many of them, an entirely different language. They didn't speak English when they came here, you know.
Right.
It is really fascinating. And like I said, you know, I'm always reminded when I read these accounts is that I'm reminded that these people just, in so many ways, strike me as being, you know, so much better you know, as people.
Yeah, we were better at that time.
You know, even though the condition, the physical anguish, you know, it was greater. But I'm talking about the mentality of these people.
Right. The quality of person we are was greater. Let me tell you something. If we are this, we've allowed ourselves to become this degraded. And we've been brought down to this state, and they release the chain, like you mentioned earlier, how they can take the chains off because we're so much more docile.
Right.
Okay. And we can't figure out how to use that freedom now, even though they put more of us in prisons than we're in 1850 now. You know, conditions haven't changed all that much, even though it appears that it has because of some of the comforts that we enjoy. We're less functional now. You know, we're less, I would say, righteous as a group, as a nation, as a, you know, group of people than we were then. So, you know, how much more improbable it would be that we could ascend from our plight, being less righteous, less aware. We are less conscious of reality than we were 150 years ago. Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just think about what you're saying and looking at under the situation, circumstances. We ain't got sense enough to even try to want to control. We got school districts. We got buildings. We could seek to dominate our own education for our own benefit. We could pull it off. We could do it. We don't want to because we're so docile. And so we educate our own people to self-destruct. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, ain't no coming back, really, once you sell yourselves out like that. And we can't just put it on the black bourgeoisie because that's another culture. And other groups of people do the same thing. You know, people. You know, I'm talking groups of our people. Other cadres, other sectors carry out a similar kind of, ambivalence. Double-mindedness,
mm-hmm.
you know, toward our condition, and not a single-mindedness toward how you know, trying to resolve many of these problems or trying to create solutions to our plight. But anyway, that's it. You know, anything else to say on what I just said? Are you ready to wrap it up?
That's it. I appreciate it. It was interesting. How many more chapters are left in that particular?
Let's see. Bibbidi bobbidi boop. How many chapters are left? I don't know. You know, let's see. I'm just slipping back. I'm trying to get.
You were going to try to make that rhyme, weren't you?
Nope.
Oh, good.
And I think it's really funny to not rhyme when you could. How to. But I don't. So it works out just the same. You see all these pages I'm turning, right?
I hear you. Hear you sound like you're rattling news.
It's crazy. I missed chapter 8. That was 9.
9, right. We finished 9. So how many are left?
We're not finishing 9. We just finished 8. We had 9. So it's probably 10 or 11. We almost out of here, though.
Okay, so we're like halfway done.
Over halfway done, I believe.
You said there are 10 or 11 more left?
10 or 11 chapters, I'm thinking.
11 chapters. Oh, wow. So we're about to be done with the book.
Right.
Wow. Now, this is the abridged version, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to do the big one. I think we'll hope this is done just to give everybody a taste, so hopefully they go out and get the other one, too.
Oh, everybody has the book. We already know. Everybody's gotten it or, you know, bought it or got it from the library, so they already had it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we won't even discuss that.
That's the appendix. I'll do an episode of we'll do another program on the other about his one of his okay, it's only 11 chapters. Okay, we almost done for sure.
Okay.
The appendix, right? This chapter 11 was quite lengthy. It's a lengthy appendix, so we'll just so we're almost done.
All right, fine. And so what book is next?
I don't know.
Okay. Being this close to the end, that's why I asked. So, you know, you could go ahead and
I got a lecture thing, a presentation I'm working on. I'm not even finished with that one. That's one about black child development.
Oh, okay, okay.
I'm still reading books for that.
Okay.
And but I'm gonna do something else in between that time. I can't. That probably ready next. We'll do something. Do something.
All right. I was just wondering, because you got to give people a chance to get the book.
Yeah, that's what they're going to do.
So that when it's time to start, they'll have the book.
Yeah, they probably, I'm going to go to this show, and I'm going to let them.
Oh, it's a shame that I couldn't say that with a straight face.
I don't even read the whole book, and they're like, that's good enough.
We have to give we have to give people an opportunity to purchase the book or go to their library and acquire it so that they can read ahead and be ready, you know, for the next time. So I just wanted to give people ample time to do that.
Yeah.
All right, I got it up.
It's a bunch of books. There is a African American Book Club reading list.
Well, we're in the anthology now, so the other whatever we're gonna do next is from that book, right?
It is, yes.
Right.
I'm gonna go over here and call it now because I forgot who that's. We're gonna do Nat Turner.
Oh, Nat Turner. Okay, that'd be good.
Confessions of Nat
Turner. Wonderful. All right.
That's a real good.
Nat Turner's next.
Right.
Sounds like a plan.
There you go. You can just go ahead and put that one out.
All right, I'll go ahead and put it out.
All right, that's it. Have a good week.
All right, see you next week, y'all. Peace.